It's always soccer in Philadelphia. In this case, it's always United States national team in Qatar in Philadelphia. I'm happy to report, everybody, that my blood pressure has dropped significantly to the point where I feel as though I can now put together a composed podcast talking about USA and Iran, or Iran, sorry, USA and Iran, the game that we witnessed as of recording yesterday. Maybe you're listening to this maybe 2 days past the final game of the group stage. And joining me on this journey for cardiac normality is Richard McGovern, returning to the program. How are you, my man?
I'm good. It's pronounced eliminated.
Oh.
Seriously, that so,
I'm like goofy. I just put the 1 year old down. I'm like, I'm operating mostly on an empty gas tank here. That's funny because I joke with my wife when the gas tank is empty, I just kind of get like giddy.
Mm-hmm.
I think like everything's funny, you know.
I hear that, but yeah, man, my that 9 minutes 53 seconds took 2 years off my life. Like, Karen and I are watching it in the living room over here, and I'm just pacing back and forth, living room to kitchen, yeah. Living room to kitchen. The only thing I can compare it to was that Flyers Bruins series in 2010.
Yeah,
when they went up in game four. Oh. Gagne scores, and the whole time I'm sitting on the couch just, oh my god.
No, I'm the same way, man. It's funny because I was like that at the beginning of the game, and you know, I'm like, I'm working, I got the laptop set up, and then I kind of like put it down. I'm like, all right, the game's about to start, whatever. And you know, I could not sit still. So I had to get up, and it's funny because I have a TV in the basement, and I built like a weight room that extends off the other side of the steps in the basement. And I can't see the TV from the weight room. I was trying to get the elliptical to line up so I could exercise and watch TV at the same time. But anyway, so I went and pulled a bunch of free weights out of the weight room. I brought them over to the TV room, and I just started lifting while I was watching the game, because I just had so much like nervous energy. I didn't know.
Yeah, you had to do something. Yeah. Like, I'm thinking back to 2010 with Donovan against Slovenia.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't remember. I was at a bar, but I don't remember being that frantically worried. But that extra time, God, I thought I was going
to
die.
I didn't. USA, Algeria didn't feel that way to me. USA, Slovenia didn't feel that way to me. The Brazil World Cup didn't feel that way. It's funny, man, because, you know, I've said this before to you and to other people, but I don't watch sports like that because after, you know, 15 years of being in the media, like, you don't really have that reaction anymore. But I think when I get to watch teams that I'm not really like, that I don't cover, I can watch them as a fan, you know, West Virginia football, basketball, United States men's national team. You know, I just like, it was nerve wracking, but it was fun because it was like, oh, this is what it feels like to be a fan again, you know? But I don't know if you feel the same way. Here's my like first actual question of the podcast, but like, I never felt like they were going to lose that game or tie. Like, I didn't feel like they weren't going to go through. Did you at any point feel otherwise?
Yeah, I absolutely felt it almost scared me when they scored first. Like, I'm more comfortable with them chasing the game, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I seriously thought Iran was going to score. The karma, the storylines, everything else. I just thought, no, this is just not our year. It's going to, you know, we didn't beat Wales. We didn't beat England. It's going to come back and bite us. I was frantically worried. I did not have a good feeling about the match before it started, and it just continued and continued and continued. And I was, I won't say shocked, but I was massively relieved when they,
it's funny, man, because it's funny because I make fun of like the Eagles fans who are yelling to like cut some dude after every mistake, or like the Eagles are 10-1 and we're bitching about like, you know, the run defense or something like that. But after that game, I was just like incensed with like Haji Wright and the way that they managed the last 9 minutes. But when I go back and I have the benefit of hindsight now and I look at the game in totality, like, They played really well over the first probably like 60 minutes, and their legs just kind of went. And then Greg made the defensive subs, and it's like, all right, I guess I'm not, I don't know. I can't be that mad about it because I'm not surprised about it. Like when you frame it in a way of knowing what Greg Berhalter is and what his limitations are, I mean, he set the team up really good in all three of these games. And then it's like kind of like in the last 20 or 30 minutes, like, you know, when they go to the subs or they go to the bench, then you kind of feel a little queasy. But it was a beautiful goal that they scored. I just, you know, I think the thing about that ball too with McKennie is he's letting it roll. Like he doesn't like stop it and like, you know, set it up or line it up or anything. He just picks his head up and he hits that while it's rolling. That's like insanely hard to do. And for Sergiño to just kind of get on the back post just to make that run early and for Christian to see that. It's almost like a Philadelphia Union going away, man. Like we talked this year about like Gajdog, like making, you know, Gajdog being in that Pulisic role and like, hey, I see this pass coming in. Now I'm going to start my run now. Yeah.
No, it was picture
perfect. Yeah.
It was a very, very similar goal in a lot of ways. But I mean, when you're talking about the defensive subs towards the end of the game, I mean, ultimately you have to make a philosophical choice, right? You're either going to defend by possession or you're going to defend by, you know, just scrambling all over the place and, you know, clearing the crease, as they say. I don't have a problem with him making the decision around the 80th minute. Look, we're going to bring in the extra defenders and we're going to bunker down. I have an issue with them bringing in Haji Wright over Jesus Faria, and I have an issue with them bringing in Shaq Moore over Joe Scally.
Yeah.
I think both of those guys, especially Faria, I mean, you see when Wright around the 8th minute of stoppage gets the ball, he's in space and he goes for the shot instead of going to the corner.
Oh my
God.
Could have
iced the game right there. And say what you want about an MLS player. An MLS player, especially for FCD, knows how to ice a freaking game in the final minute.
Yeah, they should have CONCACAFed the shit out of them. I mean, what are these guys being coached? I can't scream because the one kid just went down, but I'll do a muffled reaction to Haji Wright right now. What the hell are you doing? What the hell are you fucking doing? Just run into the corner. Run into the corner, or at least. Here's the thing. If you're going to be out there as a striker, like nobody's expecting you to, like you're just killing off the game. You got to lead, right? You got to run, dude. Mm-hmm. He's like jogging around like it's a fucking stroll in the park on Sunday afternoon. And I'm like, dude, this is the biggest game of your life. Like pressure the defenders, like try to harass them, do anything you can to try to make it uncomfortable for them. Hold the ball up, give your teammates an outlet. He looked like he was just like a second half sub in like a 1-1 game in like June.
No, he wasn't
playing with any kind of urgency at all, you know?
I had a guy tell me today that Haji Wright just looks like he's not running because he's big and lanky. He's got a smooth motion, you know, like they used to say about Keon Daniel. No. It's not that he's smooth and lanky. It's that, you know, he's not running.
Yeah. you can very easily tell when somebody is kind of like languid and like a strider.
I didn't see why he was called in. I don't see why he was put in. I, you know, a lot of people criticize Greg Berhalter. And now you go through the group stage, you don't give up a goal in the run of play, you know, and you say it's hard to criticize Greg Berhalter. Yeah. I still believe this team with several other coaches would have been better. They're winning in spite of Greg Berhalter.
Here's the thing. I don't necessarily disagree with that, you know, because it's like I I'm a big believer in the idea that more than one thing can be true. And I think Greg deserves credit for taking a young team that didn't go to the World Cup 4 years ago and getting them out of the group, you know, and having them play well defensively and be organized. I do believe that. And at the same time, I believe that another coach could probably get more out of them. You know, those ideas are not like mutually exclusive. You know what I mean? I don't think that the percentage of us who are like, who want more from Greg Berhalter, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're like, that we're anti Greg, or we're not above giving him credit where credit is due, you know, cause he's done a good job with this unit. I just feel like when the next World Cup cycle comes around, like, I just feel like there's going to be somebody who we're going to be asking ourselves these questions, man. Like, I just feel like somebody can squeeze just a little bit more, just finding those like little marginal valuable things around the edges, like getting the right subs or like figuring out what the fuck's going on with Gio Reyna, you know? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like that stuff's important. And, I disagree, man.
Larry Brown can be a great coach and Phil Jackson can be a great coach. Hmm. And they both exist in different points of a team's lifespan. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I'm not a believer in holding over national team coaches for more than one cycle. You know, Yogi Löw is the outlier. Yogi Löw is not the best example. Honestly, I'd love to see what Jim Curtin could do with this team. I really would. If he's going to leave the Union, he is a tournament coach, and he's the sort of guy that can keep a team together, especially with the challenge the U.S. is going to face in the 26th cycle, where they're not going to have qualifiers, where they're going to be going all over the world and trying to maintain a level and further integrate. I think Curtin could be a, you know, it could be a very strong hire for this team.
He's on my short list, man. It's a very short list. It only has two people.
Him and Jesse Marsh.
Jesse Marsh and Jim Curtin. Who else is even qualified, man?
Well, like, the only other way you go is you go out and you get a foreigner.
Get another German.
Yeah. Those are the two on my list as well, too.
Yeah.
They're the only two I would go for.
I just, you know, it's funny, too, because I don't want to go, like, Negadelphia. I mean, I think we're pretty pragmatic on this podcast, but, like, Christian Pulisic putting his body on the line, Weston McKennie playing as well as anybody in this tournament, Tyler Adams getting, like, international plaudits, man. That's one of my favorite things, man, is, you know, when I go on Twitter or whatever and I search, like, you know, Yunus Musa or something, right? I don't want to read the shit that, like, all the Americans are saying. Like, you know, Men in Blazers will show up at the top or something like that. I don't want to read what Men in Blazers writes about him, because I already know what they're going to say about him. You know, so I search, like, for foreign, you know, correspondence and, like, hey, what does this guy in England think of Tyler Adams? Or what does this guy in Belgium think of Weston McKennie? Or because to me, that's the real, like, unbiased, like view on all that stuff. And to me, man, like, Tyler Adams has been a friggin' superstar.
He absolutely has. I mean, yeah. Not just now, the entire qualification cycle. He was the rock of this team.
I can't believe he's only 23 at this point. That's insane. So he's going to be 27 for the World Cup when it's here. I mean, that core, my biggest takeaway, man, from all of this, and I want to frame this by saying, like, I didn't expect much of this team going into the World Cup. I've always had eyes for United States, Canada, Mexico in 2026. I know that sounds stupid to say because it's only every 4 years, but
no, you're 100%
right. They're so young that I wasn't like, what could really have been expected of them at this tournament for sure. And the core of Weston and Tyler Adams and Yunus Musa is insane. Mm-hmm. Like, as long as you got that midfield trio in there, that's awesome. You know, and Anthony Robinson and Serginho Dest, you know, the center backs we figured out, of course, but, like, and then Christian Pulisic, man, I mean, you got some, like, just amazing, like, core players for this team. There's just a lot to look forward to. That's what I'm excited about.
No, man, you are 1000% right. I think 4 years from now, I do rate Scally over, I do rate Scally over Dest, but no, it's an incredible core. It's an incredibly young core. And when you talk about Adams, the thing that I always look for when I'm looking at these rosters is, where is the greatest drop off between the starter and the backup?
Yeah.
When you look at every other position on the field, it's a cliff between Adams and Acosta. It is an absolute cliff. Yeah. If Adams were to go down, and we saw this during qualifying, if Adams were to go down, the drop-off between the two, the lack of quality, the lack of connection between the back line and the attacking midfield, it's massive.
Now, does that say more about Tyler Adams or Kellen Acosta?
I think it has more to do with Tyler Adams is so far ahead. There are certain positions, as you well know, it's the spine. Center backs, goalkeeper, holding your defensive mid, where the development is a little bit later age-wise, and the sense of how the game moves around you, the sense of how the game is going to develop, it takes longer to learn that. Adams has that much younger than a lot of players of similar skill level at his position. So there may very well be, you know, a younger guy in the U.S. system right now, but we talk about the lost generation. Who was supposed to be playing that spot? Will Trapp and Emerson Hinman, you know? Yeah. They never came along, but those are the guys you would have been expecting to start in that position.
Well, and Michael Bradley kind of
and Michael Bradley
going too long and them not turning over. I think the U.S. women's team has a little bit of problem with that too, because they have these generational amazing talents, and it's like, when is Julie Ertz supposed to pass the torch?
Well, you know, they have.
I feel like with Michael Bradley a little bit, it was almost like, hey, we got to kind of be developing the next guy here, you know.
Maybe no, it's in a way, and I'm never going to say that Kuva was a good thing. I'm never going to say it. Yeah. But in a way, it compelled a move away from these sort of liminal talents of that generation towards these younger, more dynamic guys. And regardless of what the outcome was going to be, giving them the extra 4 years, you know, to develop, I think is going to pay huge dividends in 2016.
It's amazing to me how just after Trinidad and Tobago and you know, how down everybody was on this national team. In the Dave Sarakin years or whatever, I couldn't be fucking bothered to watch 10 seconds of this team. Mm-hmm. And then you snap your fingers and it's like Pulisic is at Chelsea. McKennie is at Juventus. We got dudes playing for friggin' Barcelona and like Milan and shit. I'm like, what the hell happened here? I was like gobsmacked. Baxter's here. Here he is. Hey, bud. He doesn't get many shout outs on the podcast. He used to be like a podcast superstar, right? Now Baxter's the best. Yeah, he's making a cameo here.
I see your point, though. I 100% do. And that's where I give Berhalter a ton of credit.
Yeah.
Is that Berhalter, and this was part of the mandate U.S. Soccer gave him, but Berhalter drew a clean line under Kuva, and he said, we have 4 years to bring in an entirely new group of players and make them into a team. And that's what he did. And, you know, I give him a ton of credit for that. I'm not a fan of his match day work. I'm not really a fan of his rosters. But he had the courage to do that, and he probably had the backing to do that in a way that almost no U.S. coach has ever had.
I have a comparison. I have a metaphor an analogy, metaphor. I don't know. I'm too tired to think of which one's the right one, but I have a comparison to make. Kellen Acosta is suburban food and Tyler Adams is Philadelphia food.
That's not bad.
And it's not that suburban food's bad, because I think there's a lot of good food that's made out here. I just think that like the food in Philadelphia is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So hence to your point about the drop off, where it's like, you know, it's almost like a chicken or egg kind of thing in a weird way. Cause it's like, is the one guy just really, really good, or is the other guy shitty? Cause Kellen Acosta is like pretty damn good for MLS.
Kellen Acosta won the Gold Cup against Mexico.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's funny. Cause I, you know, to my point, I was saying about like looking at foreign correspondents and reading what other people are. I go to like the Leeds Twitter page. I read all the comments on Leeds, and they're all their fans are like dreading that he's going to get scooped up by like a, you know, a top four club or some shit, you know, and maybe he will at some point, you know, I mean, he's good enough to do it, but I've been impressed by him and just the midfield group, and Weston just makes, you know, it's insane to me, man. I was just watching. I know the Wales stink. We know the Wales stinks now, but technically they're a European side. And like, I watched the first 45 minutes of that game, and I'm like, we are like dominating possession against a UEFA team. Mm-hmm. Like this is not the United States of like 8 years ago where we were under siege for 70 minutes and we scored on like a set piece.
No,
nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, think about this with a team that with an average age of 24. And if you knock Tim Ream off that team, it's probably 22. And mm-hmm. they should have beaten Wales, and Wales was playing scared. Wales was bunkering, and they went toe to toe with England. And but for a couple bounces could have won that game.
Yeah,
beat Iran the first time the U.S. has ever beaten an Asian team in the World Cup, and now they're going through and they're going to play Holland. I mean, that's insane.
No, it's insane when you put it like that. It's crazy that I mean, when you zoom out and you look at like, I'll use a Brett Brown term. He liked to use the term snapshot, right? When you take a snapshot of what the tournament has been so far, I mean, when you lay it out plainly like that, how can you not be impressed by it? About what they've done, you know, especially when you put it up against the rest of CONCACAF too. I mean, Canada looked great in the first game they lost. Then Herdman said they were going to go out and F Croatia, and then they got F'd instead, as Kramaric said. But here's my only thing is that I don't, to the point about things being mutually exclusive and more than one thing can be true. As good as the U.S. was against England, I thought England was fucking terrible.
They were.
I had no idea what they were doing, to be quite honest. I mean, Greg set him up well, flat 4-4-2. He's like, you're not going to pass the ball to Bellingham or Rice. Play through Shaw and Trippier, you know, and Trippier. And so they were like, they kept – what was the heat? How many times do you think Harry Maguire and John Stones passed the ball back and forth to each other, like 700 times in that game?
I kept expecting somebody like Weah to just run through and grab it. You know what I mean?
I know. And it was crazy because I'm sitting here thinking, like, to me, the most obvious subs ever, like Phil Foden, because he can operate in the tight space, and Trent Alexander-Arnold just let him bomb the flank and just put crosses in or something. So I was a little surprised by that, because as good as I thought the U.S. was, and as disciplined as they were, I thought England absolutely stunk up the friggin' joint. But, I, you know, whatever, you take the result any way you can get it. And again, like, you read the British commentary after that, Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie, Christian Pulisic, you know, all that same kind of stuff, you know. Okay, so that brings us to your guys. This is like a Richard
I have forsaken them.
So here's the thing, man. So I've known you for like more than 10 years, and I've always known that you're a Netherlands dude, but I don't think I've ever been told why.
You know, I'll actually tell you. I read a book, and it was recommended to me. It was by a guy named David Winner, and it's a book I recommend to everybody. Given it as gifts, I don't know how many times. It's called Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. And there was just something in it. It describes the connection between the way the Dutch view the world, the geography, the art, the food, the music, and how it informed the development of total football. And there was just something about it that just clicked in my head. You know, the way that some people read Fever Pitch and they fell in love with Arsenal, or the way some people watch The Invincibles and, Thierry Henry and all them and fell in love with it. That was just what made me fall in love with it.
There you go.
And, I've been an Ajax fan as long as I've been a soccer fan. Always been the U.S., but I was an Ajax fan before the Union existed. So,
Okay, so I've got three possible running titles for this podcast. I haven't picked one yet. You're going to have to help me pick one. Option number one is Dutch Wonderland. Option number two is We All Hate Holland. And option number three is Cruyff wasn't that good.
I'm just going to bite my tongue on that last one.
You don't have
you're going to sound a lot like the Dutch coach if you say that.
What are we supposed to hate? I mean, it's easy to hate Iran because they're a maniacal, oppressive, theocratic, authoritarian regime that treats women like dog shit and murders their own people. So it's easy to not like them. Of course, I feel bad for their players. So a quick A side here. I can you imagine the pressure that the Iran players?
Oh God!
I mean, like you're like Osmoon, right? And like you've said your shit on Instagram about like the protests and women or whatnot, and then like he's barely mouthing the national anthem because he knows that if he doesn't, like, what the hell is going to happen to him or his family? So like I like, you cannot put into any kind of words what those dudes must have been feeling before that game, during that game, after that game. So I hope that, you know, they all make it through this relatively unscathed. Put them on a plane here. Bring them in and do a dispersal draft and give them all MLS teams.
Absolutely. Did you see that footage of Anthony Robinson and the one Iranian player? He's just crying on Robinson's shoulder. It's absolutely breathtaking. And I have nothing but – I mean, the Iranian players, they played hard.
Yeah.
They played fair. You know, you can't blame them for their government. You can't blame them for any of that. And to have the courage to say the things that the captain said, to have the courage to stand there in the first game and not sing the national anthem, and to still go out there and not buckle to that pressure, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, that's the shit that'll get me to buy somebody's jersey. I don't wear jerseys anymore, but I would buy like a Sardar Azmoun jersey. Who's he play for, like Leverkusen or something? I'll buy a Leverkusen jersey. You know, I'll rock that shit for real. Yeah, I'm like, credit to those guys for – I mean, I can't imagine. Like, I have no idea what that's like, and hopefully never will. But anyway, what are we supposed to hate the Netherlands for? Like tulips, like good engineering, free
New York
air. What do you?
if it wasn't for the Dutch, Pennsylvania wouldn't exist. So there is that.
By the way, I just that's funny because if I do, I keep seeing the Pennsylvania Dutch joke, and but underneath every single Pennsylvania Dutch joke, it's like,
we're really
that
German.
Actually meant that they were German, you know.
There's not much other than Louis van Gaal himself and maybe Nigel de Jong. There's not too much to hate about the Dutch. I hate to say it. Stroop waffles are delicious. Wind power is ahead of its time, and they hated Spain before it was cool. So there's not too much to hate about it.
I should text Ernie and see how he's feeling. It's like the Richard McGovern, Ernie Stewart, and Serginho Dest Super Bowl here. here's my uneducated take, because I don't watch as much of the foreign game as I used to. My casual take on the Netherlands is like, yeah, they're damn good, but they're not the Netherlands of 8 years ago or 10 years ago. Is that an accurate take?
That's 100% true. And in fact, you know, you think of the Netherlands, you think of total football, you think of the 4-3-3. These guys play, to make it easy for everybody, these guys play Thomas Tuchel's Chelsea. They play a 3-5-2 attacking and a 5-3-2 defending. They're a very functional side with a couple of individually brilliant players. They have maybe two of the best center backs in the world in Virgil van Dijk and Matthijs de Ligt, but you can't put both of them on the field at the same time. Mm-hmm. They have some very, very good Champions League level wingers. They have two Champions League level attackers, not true strikers, not true wingers, in Memphis Depay and Cody Gakpo. But they can be beaten, and this U.S. side actually lines up very well against them. The other thing to understand is that Louis van Gaal is now in his third run as Netherlands coach. He got brought in to replace Koeman when Koeman went to Barcelona.
Yeah.
He is entirely obsessed with finally winning a World Cup. Johan Cruyff never did. Van Gaal has always been the number two in the history of Dutch soccer.
Yeah.
And he is playing the most functional, dirty is not the right word, but the most functional, most basic defensive Dutch team he's ever put out there.
Yeah.
Because he just wants to win. He's playing not to lose. And a U.S. team can attack that, and a U.S. team can really, I think, match up well here.
Well, listen, I think the good thing is that, you know, the United States midfield isn't going to have to worry about Nigel De Jong coming with a flying kung fu kick to take anybody's head off this time around. But I think they've got, like, first of all, Louis van Gaal is what, like 90 years old at this point, right? He is like a dinosaur.
He's in his 70s, and you know, and good luck to him. He's suffering from he's actually fighting right now cancer.
I feel like such a dickhead now for saying that. Maybe
I'll they call him the Iron Tulip for a reason. You know,
he's got the Iron Tulip. Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, I like that. There's something to me that feels like I don't know him coaching this team feels like a I don't know. I'm trying to think.
You remember when we brought Bruce Arena back in 2017?
Yes.
That's what this is.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like he fits. It doesn't feel like the coach fits the players or vice versa. It's like two different timelines or something.
He doesn't, and he's cranky, and it gets in his way.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. The Netherlands goalkeepers right now are a 38-year-old, 37-year-old, and a career backup. And two of them had, before the World Cup, less than 8 caps between them.
Is that that's what you were bitching about on Twitter? Because I didn't really get the
Jasper Cillessen got ducked out of a bunch of qualifiers.
Yeah.
Because he got COVID, and he got wound up on Van Gaal's bad side, and so Jasper Cillessen, one of the probably the best Dutch goalkeeper of the last 20 years, is sitting at home right now. You know, he's had similar issues with Memphis in the past. He's had similar issues. Matthijs de Ligt almost walked out of the team after the first game against Senegal because he started him on the wrong side and played him out of position.
He looked rough. Like, I watched like the first 20 minutes of that game. I was like, whoa, this is not.
That's exactly it. And he is very set in his ways, and he's not a good match for this team, but he was the best available coach at that point.
He doesn't play. Does De Ligt play? They don't play a back three at Juve, do they?
De Ligt is at Bayern now, and he plays
Yes, you're right. Okay, right.
He's never played a back three. Even that Ajax squad that made it to the Champions League semifinals, he was captain there. Yeah. Back four. It's always 4-3-3 is where he's excelled.
Shows you how much I've been paying attention because he's at the wrong team. All right, let me just pause for a quick moment here for a Seinfeld clip.
What is Holland? What do you mean, what is it? It's a country right next to Belgium.
No, that's the Netherlands.
Holland is the Netherlands.
Then who are the Dutch?
See, I think that's a fair question. I, you know, it's like, to me, like Americans don't understand the difference between the UK and England and Great Britain. And then you have Ireland, which is not part of it. So what is the difference between the Netherlands and Holland?
All right. So Netherlands and Belgium were all part of what we call the Spanish Low Countries.
Okay.
And anyway, they got split Catholic on one side and Protestant on the other, and the Protestant side became the Netherlands. It's made up of states, just like the U.S. Huh. So if you were to call the Netherlands Holland, it would be like calling the whole United States California.
Uh-huh. Okay, I see. Interesting.
Yeah, and Amsterdam's the biggest city, but the capital's The Hague, so it's a little bit like New York and D.C., you know,
yeah.
It's that sort of
thing. Yeah, okay. What are we at? Like almost a half hour now. I think we'll do like two more questions here. I'll give you fill in the blank. We'll end it on a pair of matching fill in the blanks questions. The Netherlands wins if blank.
The Netherlands wins if the U.S. sits back and allows Frankie de Jong to establish a good rhythm passing and lets the wingers run off of him.
Well, I guess it's pretty obvious to answer this next one. The United States wins if blank.
The United States wins if they press. They've got Brendan Aaronson. They've got Gio Reyna. They've got Christian Pulisic. They've got Tyler Adams. They've got guys who have run the gegenpress. If you look at what Ecuador did, Ecuador limited the Netherlands to two shots. It's a record. No European team had been held to less than three shots since 1966. Hold the ball up, force them to compact their defense and bring their wingers in, and you can control their attack and hold them in your attacking third.
Yeah.
It's very simple. If you compress them, they can't break out. If they can't break out, they can't attack. Their defenders start getting in their own way.
I think the Netherlands is beatable, man. That doesn't necessarily mean that the United States is going to do it, but Greg has had them set up well in these three games, and you know, he's had the tactics right, you know. So my philosophy here is like, it's not exactly the Philadelphia Phillies of 2022 where I felt like they were playing with house money, but in a way, whenever you're the United States and you reach the knockout rounds, you're sort of, it is almost house money at that point, because nobody in the world really expects you to be in the final eight, you know, or the final four or whatever. So I would love to see them if they're going to go out by playing their fucking game and trying to take it to them. The one thing I don't want to do is see them sit back and turn this into Belgium in 2014 where, you know, Tim Howard looks like Neo from the Matrix and has to like bail our asses out over and over and over. I don't want it to be that kind of game. I think that's conceding defeat. I think to me, the biggest takeaway from the United States in this entire World Cup is that we're playing the same way as the good teams in the world. We're no longer technically and tactically inferior and just getting by on American resilience and hard work and effort, you know, and then like nicking a set piece, right? Like that's I want everybody to hear this like loud and clear. Like we're not bad anymore.
This is not 2002. This is not 2010.
Yeah.
If the U.S. team that played Wales and that played England shows up against Holland, they have a real, not just a puncher's chance, they have a real chance to win that game. They genuinely do. This Netherlands team is beatable.
Yeah.
And the U.S., you know, you look at the Ecuador game, this U.S. team has the potential to win and win playing their game. And, you know, I can't give a stronger endorsement than that.
Rick, man, I'll say this to end it. Like, we've got ballers on this team. Like, these guys are technically good. They're proficient. They play for the biggest teams in the world. This isn't like David versus Goliath anymore, you know, like we have dudes who are damn good, you know, and that's what's been pleasing to me more than anything, seeing Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie and Serginho Dest and all these guys like show that like they belong and they can play for the best teams in the best leagues in the world. And that's just win, lose, draw, penalty kicks, whatever bullshit happens, you know, crap red card or something. Like I would consider Saturday a success if they go out and just play the way that they've been playing up until this point, the style that they've been playing, and say this is not your grandmother's United States national team, you know?
No, it's 100% true. I'm going to tell you right now, I think the U.S. is going to win 2-1.
Wow, you heard it here first. I think it's 1-1. I think it goes into extra time. And then as Carrie Underwood once said, Jesus will take the wheel from there. This is a Super Bowl, man. I pray for your blood pressure Saturday. I pray for mine as well. I haven't smoked a cigarette. I've smoked 4 cigarettes, I think, in my entire life. But I was thinking of making it 5 after the Iran game. So hopefully we'll keep Philip Morris away from me after this one. But it's always a pleasure, man. I appreciate you coming on. And you know, who knows what the hell happened, you know?
We'll see. Yeah, and you know, winner gets Argentina, so that's not too bad, yeah?
It's always soccer in Philadelphia. Remember, Cruyff wasn't that good.
Oh, come on.